Welcome to the Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the people responsible for the advances in science and techniques that were used to catch the murderers. We will talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science, or the people yielding it, failed in their quest to catch a killer. My name is Lisa. I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. I am curiously fascinated in how and why these crimes happen and how science has developed to catch and convict these criminals. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. I know I'm not the only one out here fascinated by the science of murder and true crime, so I want us to find each other and learn together. I initially began this podcast 2 years ago while on medical leave from work. Life has been a roller coaster since then, with me eventually losing that job, recovering, working as a traveling healthcare professional, which is where you take short-term 3 to 6 month contracts in other parts of the country to help at understaffed facilities, and then return home and find another permanent position and settling in there. However, throughout that time, I never lost interest in continuing this podcast or in sharing my interest in forensic science, science in general, the psychology and sociology of people, and the science of murder. Today, we are discussing the science of blunt force trauma, specifically as a cause of death, what it is, the way it contributes to death, and cases where it was the primary cause of death. Let's define our terms so we can discuss how you die from blunt force injuries. Physical trauma caused by an external force is generally divided into three main categories based on how the injury occurs: blunt force, sharp force or penetrating, and deceleration trauma. Blunt force injuries are caused by dull objects impacting the body. These wounds can include abrasions, contusions, and lacerations. Abrasions are scrapes or grazes on the outermost layer of the skin. Contusions include bruises, which develop from damage to blood vessels, which then cause bleeding under the skin. Lacerations are torn, ragged wounds in the tissue. These are cuts or tears that aren't necessarily from a bladed or sharp object, like the edge of a counter or table. Blunt force injuries to the head or severe blood loss from these injuries are the most common life-threatening outcomes and often require immediate medical care. Sharp force injuries are inflicted by a blade or other object with an edge. They are characterized as either incised wounds or stab wounds. Incised wounds are caused by sharp-edged objects like knives, razor blades, or glass. The injury occurs when the cutting edge moves across the tissue surface, often the skin. An incised wound is typically longer than it is deep. Stab wounds are penetrating injuries caused by objects with a sharp pointed end, such as daggers, scissors, or ice picks. A stab wound is characteristically deeper than it is wide. And then a less common injury, the chop wound, shows characteristics of both blunt and sharp force trauma. Deceleration injury happens when a body is within or on a rapidly moving object, like in a vehicle, that comes to a sudden, abrupt stop. The forces exerted during this rapid slowing or halting can cause injury. It can also occur if a person is ejected from a moving vehicle. A person who falls forward and impacts an object like a steering wheel or the dashboard of a car can have a combination of deceleration injuries, blunt force trauma, and sharp force trauma from the impact. When a person's body continues moving rapidly forward and then is suddenly stopped by the impact, such as hitting the steering wheel, the internal organs continue to move forward for a fraction of a second, potentially tearing away from their attachments like ligaments and blood vessels, resulting in a deceleration injury. The immediate collision of the body, whether chest, the head, limbs, etc., with a broad, dull object like a steering wheel or the dashboard constitutes blunt force trauma. This, in turn, can cause external injuries like bruises and lacerations, and internal injuries like broken bones, for example, the ribs. While broken bones themselves are a result of the blunt force, their resulting damage to the internal structures is characterized differently. A sharp, jagged end of a fractured rib can lacerate or puncture organs like the lung or the liver. This type of damage, caused by a sharp internal fragment, is considered secondary sharp force trauma or a penetrating injury, even though the force that started it was blunt. Got it? So we're going to talk about blunt force today. Someone hitting or getting hit in the head, someone getting beat to death, that kind of thing. When determining the cause of death, forensic pathologists use the specific pattern of injuries, such as the shape of a skull fracture or the presence of pattern bruising, to determine what kind of object, if any, was used to create that injury. In this context, blunt force murder weapons are often characterized by their form, their weight, the way they were acquired, such as whether an object was likely a weapon of opportunity, something that was already present in the environment where the altercation occurred, or whether it was brought to the scene by the assailant. Weapons of opportunity are often used in these kind of cases, whether domestic objects like heavy decorations, frying pans, glass bottles, or heavy tools that are present in some workplaces. Often the weapon is whatever's at hand. In spaces where sports equipment is available, such as baseball bats, pool cues, golf clubs, these objects can lead to high-velocity blows while maintaining distance from the victim. Sometimes the weapon is not what hits the victim, but what the victim is hit against. Floors and walls can actually be weapons of opportunity. In a struggle, a victim may be shoved, slammed, or thrown against these hard surfaces. Forensic experts distinguish this by looking for inertial injuries, such as coup contre coup injuries, where the brain moves within the skull, which has both impact points and possibly tearing of internal structures. Additionally, in many cases of domestic violence or crimes against children, no external tool is used. The hands and feet of the attacker are weapons enough for murder. Hands and fists can result in injuries that are often soft tissue trauma, but can be lethal if the blows are directed at vulnerable areas, such as the throat or the temple. Kicking or stomping with the feet generates much more force than a punch. Bones break, vessels tear. Injuries are left behind that resemble patterned abrasions that mirror the sole of an attacker's shoe. This is a particularly brutal form of blunt force, often seen in mob attacks or overkill scenarios. Personal weapons, such as someone's hands or feet or personal items, are more commonly associated with heat of passion or rage killings. Things like hammers or other tools that are readily available are then frequently associated with premeditated or overkill blunt force murders. Choosing a heavy tool like a sledgehammer reflects a specific intent to ensure a lethal outcome. Someone is likely to die. Now, let's discuss some cases where blunt force trauma was the mechanism or cause of death. The first case that came to mind for me when I tried to think of people who died as a result of blunt force trauma was that of Matthew Shepard. He was a student at the University of Wyoming who was beaten, tortured, and left tied to a fence near Laramie on October 6, 1998. The direct cause of his death were severe head injuries he sustained during a brutal beating. He suffered catastrophic physical damage, including fractures to the back of his head and a severe brainstem injury. After he was found tied to that fence, he was transported to a hospital in Fort Collins, Colorado, where he was in a coma for 6 days. He never regained consciousness and died on October 12, 1998. His cause of death was officially classified as murder by way of blunt trauma. Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson were arrested shortly after the attack and eventually charged with first-degree murder, among other charges. Russell Henderson pleaded guilty to the murder and kidnapping charges in a pretrial agreement to avoid the death penalty. Aaron McKinney did not accept a plea and went to trial. The jury found him guilty of felony murder, among other charges. The prosecution in this case was seeking the death penalty. However, Matthew Shepard's parents intervened and brokered a plea deal, asking the prosecution to spare McKinney's life. McKinney accepted the offered deal and was also sentenced to 2 consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. This isn't as much a case of using scientific theory to provide evidence of guilt, but rather that the deliberate trauma inflicted upon Matthew is the cause of death itself. Matthew Shepard died due to the beating he received. What makes this case particularly notable, especially if you're too young to remember it, is that it became a catalyst to change national law. Matthew Shepard was beaten to death, and the consensus view that propelled the national conversation and legislation is that Matthew Shepard's identity as a gay man was a central reason he was targeted for robbery and subsequently brutalized. Legally, the motive successfully proven in court was felony murder during the commission of a robbery. The public outcry and attention surrounding the case, which was labeled as a hate crime by many people, but not by existing Wyoming law, led to the eventual passage of the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act by the U.S. Congress in 2009, nearly a decade later. This act expanded federal hate crime law to include crimes motivated by a victim's actual or perceived sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability. Similar future crimes could be prosecuted with this as an established aggravating factor. The U.S. is not alone in this kind of crime. In the murder of Jody Dabrowski, an anti-gay motive was also considered an aggravating circumstance. Jody was a 24-year-old assistant bar manager in South London, England. On October 14, 2005, at around midnight, he was beaten to death with punches and kicks by two men who believed him to be gay. While walking home alone, Jody Dabrowski was intercepted by Thomas Pickford and Scott Walker, who targeted him for his perceived sexual orientation. The ensuing assault involved repeated punching, kicking, and stomping, resulting in 33 distinct blunt force injuries. Witnesses liken the ferocity of the attack to the slaughter of an animal. Due to the severity of the facial trauma, described in court as a bloody, swollen pulp, Dabrowski's family was unable to identify him. Investigators eventually confirmed his identity through fingerprints. While there were only two attackers, it was carried out with a mob-like frenzy. While Thomas Pickford was definitely an active participant, he later claimed that he had just been too frightened to stop the assault. Walker was frenzied and was definitely leading the attack. At some point, he even hit Jody with his own shoe and then stuffed his sock in his mouth to possibly choke or suffocate him during the beating. It was likely also an act of humiliation and dehumanization. Witnesses who were at the scene identified Walker as the more aggressive of the two men. Here's the thing, though. Whichever man ultimately struck the killing blow, or what their motivation was, the man died, and they were both guilty of murder. Much like Matthew Shepard, Jody Dabrowski did not die instantly. Blunt force trauma is rarely that kind. Instead, death is a cumulative process of systemic failure. It results from catastrophic brain injury, hypovolemic shock following massive internal hemorrhage, or asphyxiation as the airway is compromised by trauma and fluids. In some cases, vital organs simply shut down under the physical stress. For Jody, this process lasted nearly half a day. He was found unconscious at midnight, and he succumbed to his injuries 10 and a half hours later at St. George's Hospital in Tooting. Thomas Pickford and Scott Walker were known criminals with extensive records, and they had carried out similar homophobic assault just 2 weeks prior to this incident. This was not the first time these men had targeted a victim, but given their life sentences, hopefully it'll be the last. In this case, justice moved fairly swiftly. In June 2006, less than a year after the murder, both men pled guilty and were sentenced to life imprisonment. They must serve a minimum of 28 years before even being considered for parole, though the judge noted that they may serve significantly longer. In more recent news, I recall the social media coverage of the death of Amber Check in November 2025. Her senseless murder was essentially captured on video. According to the criminal complaint, surveillance footage shows David Bruce DeLong entering the facility where both he and Amber worked, putting on gloves, retrieving a sledgehammer, and walking directly to Check's workstation. Although he walked out of frame, he allegedly struck her multiple times, including downward blows consistent with her already being on the ground. Amber was only 20 years old and had been working at Advanced Process Technology since July, having just received her certification in May. On her days off, she even taught welding at her former high school. DeLong, a 40-year-old man, stated that he just didn't like her. Apparently, he felt that was justification enough to brutally murder her. The available surveillance footage and the criminal complaint showed that she had been struck multiple times. The first strike was delivered while she was standing at her workstation, and approximately four additional strikes were delivered after she had fallen to the ground. She never had a chance to fight back. Due to the severity of the injuries from the sledgehammer, life-saving measures attempted by deputies and paramedics were unsuccessful. Amber was pronounced dead at the scene shortly after 6 a.m. The primary cause of death was officially determined to be blunt force trauma to the head. First responders described the scene as involving major head trauma and significant blood loss. The brutality of these injuries led the Wright County Attorney to pursue an indictment for first-degree premeditated murder, for which David Bruce DeLong was indicted in December 2025. A conviction on first-degree murder carries a mandatory sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. DeLong remains in custody at the Wright County Jail. In this particular case, there was a large concentration of items, the tools of their profession in the vicinity, that were not intended to be weapons, but were available nearby during a rage or blitz attack. Again, the attacker took advantage of that, using weapons of opportunity, as are often done in these kinds of assault. Aside from lethal assaults, blunt force trauma can be accidental, such as in hit and runs or workplace incidents involving heavy machinery. However, it's frequently the result of a primal, personal form of violence. This is especially common in crimes against children, perpetrated by adults in positions of power, or in mob scenarios where multiple offenders target a single victim. In researching these cases, I found it difficult to isolate blunt force trauma as the sole cause of death. Instead, it often serves as a blitz attack meant to incapacitate a victim before the final act of homicide, such as stabbing or strangulation. Psychological profiles support this. Because these attacks require close proximity and extreme physical exertion, investigators often categorize them as overkill, an expression of intense personal rage rather than mere clinical execution. Many serial killers have inflicted physical trauma and blunt force injuries on their victims, but ultimately committed the actual murder by stabbing, strangling, or other forms of violence. In the hierarchy of lethal violence, blunt force trauma is frequently the prelude. Serial offenders often utilize concussive force to gain total control over the victim, ensuring that they are physically unable to resist the more prolonged ritualistic violence that follows. Blunt force trauma serves then as a precursor or contributing element to their preferred lethal methods. The forensic reality of blunt force trauma as a mechanism of murder reveals a chilling paradox. While it is the most primitive form of violence, it often requires the most deliberate physical effort. Forensic pathologists often distinguish these deaths by the presence of defense wounds, such as fractures to the forearms or hands, which tell the story of a victim's final moments of consciousness. Rather than when these wounds are absent and the trauma is localized entirely to the skull, it suggests a more blitz-style attack, designed to end the victim's struggle before an attack begins, rather than the mechanism of the attack itself. I find it difficult to imagine the kind of anger, rage, and hatred that a person has to harbor to inflict this sort of violence upon another person. Can't think that there is much rational thought in the head of the perpetrator. Certainly no recognition of the victim as a person. The first blow is rarely the killing blow, or even the second. It often comes after the victim is knocked to the ground, defenseless, and yet the perpetrator does not stop. They do not consider their actions. They often dehumanize their victim as justification. It is the ultimate escalation of abuse, where primal rage is physically manifested, resulting in the total erasure of a human life. What do you think? I'd love to hear your opinion. You can contact me on social media or through email about these cases or any future topics you'd like to suggest. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder. I can also be reached at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to this podcast to continue learning about the science of murder. I hope to have you back for the next episode, and please leave a review of these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcast provider, and encourage your accomplices, I mean friends, to learn along with us.